Poddo.
The Conservatives are the largest party. They don't have an overall majority at this stage. The Prime Minister called this election because she wanted certainty and stability. This doesn't seem to look like certainty and stability.
Welcome to Polling Politics.
Hello, and welcome to another special edition of Polling Politics. We're looking at Super Thursday, as I, and admittedly very few other people, are calling it. Today's episode is all about Scotland. I'm delighted to be joined by Professor Elsa Henderson, Professor of Political Science at the University of Edinburgh. Her latest book is Englishness, The Political Force Transforming Britain. We're also joined by Mark Shepherd. He's Senior Lecturer in Politics at the School of Governance and Public Policy at the University of Strathclyde and was Principal Investigator on the Future of the United Kingdom and Scotland Research Project. His previous books include Automatic Three-Dimensional Mesh Generation for the Modified Octree Technique and its sequel, Automatic Three-Dimensional Mesh Generation by the Finite Octree Technique. It could be a different Mark Shepherd, you might argue, but it was on Google Scholar, so I'm sticking with it. Elsa, I'd like to start with you. How do things look now in Scotland? And how do you think they will look the day after Super Thursday, less Super Friday, as I'm calling it? Because Scotland was a very interesting part of this group of elections that's taking place. And I think it remains a key focus for many people.
I suppose in one way, it's a far more exciting election than we would have thought. Like if you were looking at the polling in the summer, it was hard to imagine that there would be any result other than a clear SNP majority or a clear win and quite likely a majority. And we know that polling preferences have changed, or voting intention preferences have changed in the 6 months before an election before. But that scale of change required to kind of make this interesting didn't look likely. So it looked at the outset like it was going to be a fairly dull event. But it's been energized by a number of different things. One is the slight slip in the SNP in the polls. It's not in question who will win the election, but that majority is in real doubt. We've got a new political party led by former First Minister Alex Salmond. And because they're running on the list only, that also could deprive the SNP of some list seats. So ALBA could be responsible for taking the SNP over into a majority in support of independence, but it could also prevent the SNP from getting the very majority that it seeks. And the third thing really is despite all expectations, an energized Scottish Labour Party, which in the past couple of elections has routinely been polling so dismally. I think we were all expecting yet another dismal run. And yet the new leader's personal polling is very strong. They're retaining more of their voters from past elections than they have been recently. So there's a re-energized Scottish Labour Party as well to kind of throw into the mix. So it's much more exciting now than it looked like it would be even a few months ago.
And Mark, you've looked particularly at the communications that the parties are undertaking in the run-up to this election. How are things looking in that respect?
Yes, I mean, what's quite interesting is this election seems to be about a mandate for a second referendum. So I thought I'd look into the manifestos to see how often independence was mentioned. And at the time I did this, Labour's had a bit of a recent run. And I think that's possibly something to do with Anas Sarwar and his message during the debates in terms of focusing on a national recovery in which we all work together. That seems to be the message he's been trying to push home. And if you look at voters who maybe are thinking about voting but aren't voting or haven't voted in the past, they've wanted politicians not to work for themselves and to be less kind of working together. So I think Sarwar's been picking up on that message and it's working. But if we look at the manifestos, the two that I compared, the Conservatives and the SNP, and the SNP, there's one mentioned by the leader, Nicola Sturgeon, on independence, and three mentions. The Conservatives are front-loading this message on independence and the threat to independence for the recovery of the United Kingdom and for Scotland. And although the manifestos, both manifestos, do talk about independence, what's really interesting is the individual leaflets that you get through the door, which is what most voters see. So if we look at, British election study data, for example, 83% of people, over 80% of people regularly report having seen these election communications. It's really just people like myself, you, Joe, and Elsa, who would be looking up the manifestos. You know, you really have to dig deep to go through the manifestos because they are quite meaty tomes, but we all get to see the leaflets. Now, the leaflets, the SNP leaflets that I've seen, have made no mention of independence at all. And the Conservative leaflets, they mention it on the first page, they mention it on the second page, third page, fourth page. It's just all about independence and the threat to recovery.
That's interesting because, of course, this, from the point of view of people outside Scotland, this is very much presented as a contest about independence. But obviously, we have issues around COVID, both in Scotland and then the whole of response across the UK. And, of course, the question of Brexit and the impact that has had in Scotland. Elsa, what's your sense of what will be driving the vote at this election? Is it really, for most people, simply a question of independence, or do these other factors have an important role to play as well?
So it's an interesting one. In the polls, they ask what's the most important issue, and those most important issue ones are the same as we always see, regardless of which level the election is taking place. It's the economy, education, and health. If you ask people what's the most important issue to help you make up your mind in this election, slightly different though, and we find that folks tend to put independence and the question of the Constitution first on that list. So it's clear that independence is having, or your view on the Constitution is having, a role in how people are casting their ballots. But I think that is bound up with assessments of competence. And I think it would be foolish to ignore the fact that the SNP does well, not just because it is the largest pro-independence party and it's able to grab support from yes voters, but because it is perceived to be the most competent party across a range of policy areas. And you can see Labour are getting close to them on issues of education. Labour are getting close to them in terms of managing inequality. But in terms of their handling of the economy, in terms of how they've handled coronavirus, how they'll handle the Brexit transition and standing up for Scotland, as well as all the other issues that are asked, the SNP are clearly ahead of all the other parties. And the data also suggest that there's a bit of a COVID bounce for the SNP, because Nicola Sturgeon's personal polling, but also the party's competence polling on COVID, is stronger than average, right? So they're being helped by an electorate that believes that they have handled COVID as well as they have. And so it's filtering out into the competence measures. Yes, independence is important, but it would be wrong, I think, to suggest that just regular valence issues around competence don't matter.
Mark, this election is perhaps a little unusual in that we have two relatively new leaders for both Conservative and Labour. Douglas Ross became Conservative leader back in August 2020, and Anna Sarwar more recently in February of this year. How has that, if at all, influenced the way that the parties communicate, particularly, of course, also in the context of not just new leaders, but new parties emerging with the ALBA party and All for Unity, as well as many other smaller parties?
I live in the west of Scotland, and we've got 17 parties on the regional list plus two independents. I've never seen it. It was so long, my ballot. I've never seen anything like it. It was like an American ballot with all the different options that you might get. But I do think it's difficult because Nicola Sturgeon has such a presence in Scotland, and it really does look, it's very, very difficult. And we've seen this over time with multiple Labour leader changes. It's very, very difficult for Labour to get a purchase on a party like the SNP that has pretty much taken the Labour ground. And so what we have is kind of you've got a left of centre party, the SNP, and you've got a left of centre party, the Labour Party in Scotland. The main distinction is about where they stand in terms of the constitutional issue. So it's very, very difficult to get out from under that one particular issue for both of the leaders. And I think with Douglas Ross has got a similar issue. He's not Ruth Davidson, and she was very popular as a Conservative leader. You know, Douglas Ross, I don't think, comes across as well as Ruth Davidson did. But yet the media tend to focus on, or the public tend to focus, if we look at social media discussions, it's all about Nicola Sturgeon versus Boris Johnson. And it all goes back to the constitutional issue about who would you rather have making decisions for Scotland. And that's kind of where the message gets stuck. And it's very difficult for Douglas Ross to get purchase, and it's very difficult for Anna Sawar to do the same.
Elsa, I'd like to ask you a question, and then Mark, I'll come on to ask you the same. What will you be paying particular attention to in Scotland over the next couple of weeks? And what more widely across the rest of the UK will you be paying particular attention to?
I mean, partly I'm just trying to survive to Saturday, and then I'm just going to go to sleep for a little bit.
I know the feeling well.
There's certain things I'm looking for on the night, right? And some of them are with my, you know, Scottish election study hat on. I'm interested in looking to see what's going on when we get the data back about how people feel about an election in a pandemic, right? I mean, we've got questions in the survey about how people feel ahead of the polls, ahead of the vote, how they feel about going to the polling station. And we've also got questions in the post about how people felt about it. For me, I mean, there's something strange about an election in the middle of a pandemic. It's odd not to have people coming by your door. It's odd not to have street stalls. I'm interested to see whether the debates matter. We know that the debates people tend not to watch the debates. And those who do watch the debates, they never bump them off their actual preferences. So they are, purely from a cephalological point of view, they are pointless exercises in that respect. But it's been, you know, we've all been locked up in our houses, and there's not an awful lot else going on. So I am
ways they're the most interesting thing happening.
Yeah, I am interested to see whether they've made a difference in terms of how people make up their minds in an election. So that's one thing. I'm interested in the data that we get back in terms of how people have engaged with this election, whether they've gone to the same sources for information, how they felt about their trip to the polls, and whether the things that we think sometimes don't matter actually end up mattering. Similarly, I'm interested in what's going on with Labour, because the inability of Scottish Labour to kind of stem the flow of voters away from them, mostly to the SNP, but partly to the Conservative Party, seems to have stopped. And I'm interested to see whether they've actually started to regain some of those voters that they had previously lost. So there's certain things I'm looking for in terms of the data that we get back. In terms of the election result, obviously, it depends what the results are, but it will be very interesting to see what that does in terms of maneuvers for a second independence referendum. And so I think everyone's eyes are going to be on people's attitudes to timing, people's attitudes to whether they have a mandate and under what conditions they have a mandate. And if the UK government says no, what should the Scottish government do? So we've got lots of polling on those kinds of things. And we'll start to kind of turn our heads towards that a little bit more once we know the result.
And Mark, same question to you. What will you be paying particular attention to in Scotland and indeed in the rest of the UK?
Sure. I think on the night there are some target seats. So Dumbarton, East Lothian, Edinburgh. These are SNP targets to steal from Labour. There's also SNP targets to steal from the Conservatives, Edinburgh Central, Dumfriesshire, Aberdeenshire West. I think, you know, there aren't that many seats that are close in terms of about 10 that could do it. Eastman's always interesting. It's a three-way marginal. So it's a Conservative, Labour, SNP marginal. So, and then also what might happen in the North East region? Will Alba, you know, that's kind of Alex Salmond's territory. Will they pick up a seat there? And what will that mean? But I think what's going to be the most important thing after this election is going to be about mandates that are claimed. And we need to pay attention to how those mandates are claimed. So the common way of doing this is in terms of the seats that you have. Now, if the SNP, and it looks like they might just not get a majority, but it looks like there will be a mandate in terms of seats, if you want to calculate it that way, if the Greens are calculated into that. So the Greens plus the SNP looks like they're going to get a majority. And actually, what was quite interesting, there was a poll, I think it was YouGov, that looked at members, and it looks like the SNP members are much more favourable of doing a deal with the Greens than they are of doing a deal with the ALBA party. So, I mean, there's obviously, that's quite interesting. But I think in terms of the mandate, the opposition parties, the unionist parties, they're going to look at the percentage of votes. They're going to look at the percentage of votes from the total electorate. And when you start to look at mandates in those terms, then the level of support for the main parties becomes quite low. And so, for example, if we were to go back to the Conservative general election where they won in 2019, you know, they've got percentage of votes in the total electorate is under 30%. You know, the SNP mandate in that election, although they got 48 up 59 seats, they're getting around 31% of the vote. That's not a mandate. That's about less than a third of the public. So I think what's going to be really interesting after this election is how people are discussing mandates and what figures they are using for that.
And so with that in mind, what would success look like for the SNP, do you think?
Well, for them, I mean, they've been very clear, particularly since the start of the ALBA party, that they want a majority on their own. And you can understand why they want a majority on their own. It makes it a much simpler case for them to make. But they're also probably looking at the polling, which suggests that even SNP voters and Yes supporters themselves see a distinction between an SNP majority and an SNP plus others majority. They're much happier with that scenario in terms of going faster, claiming a mandate for a referendum and going faster on a referendum. And if there's a distinction in the minds of SNP supporters and Yes supporters in terms of the benefit of an SNP majority, you can bet that the UK government would also evaluate it along similar lines. It would be much easier to say no if it's a majority cobbled together from a range of different parties than if it's one party that wins a majority of votes and a majority of seats. So it makes life a lot easier for them if it's a majority. And since ALBA's been created, they've been making that case that no, don't park that list vote with anyone other than us. Keep that with us, and it strengthens our hands. So for them, I think that's clear. In terms of the domestic agenda, they'll be fine either way. And in fact, Mark's absolutely right. The polling suggests that the electorate as a whole is happiest with a coalition between the SNP and the Greens. So as far as the electorate is concerned, a win is a slightly different scenario than what the SNP identifies as a win.
And so turning that around, does that mean that if the SNP does not gain a majority, would that be seen as a success for Labour and the Conservatives, perhaps?
I think it depends on how Labour itself performs on the night in terms of both share the votes and share the seats. I think that very much... The one benefit of being the Scottish Labour Party is that things have been so dire for so long that any modest improvement is fantastic. So yes, I think they'll be looking at more finely tuned incremental changes and claiming victory on the basis of that. And to be honest, actually, they won't be wrong. Reversing the trend of what's been going on since the 2014 referendum in Scotland, reversing that trend of decline would be an incredible achievement for Scottish Labour.
I'm also kind of intrigued by that. There's always like about just under 10% of SNP voters who aren't in favour of independence. So if this is seen as being very close, and that, Elsa, that's your data that I'm taking there from, I think you're with Rob Johns, yourself and Chris Carman, you had 9% of the vote for the SNP as a no vote, is a no to it. Mm-hmm. So I think Curtis just recently found that it was about 8%. So somewhere in that region. Yeah. So wondering, you might think, well, why would people do that? But there is some semblance that, you know, if you vote for the SNP, they're able to extract the biggest concessions out of Westminster. So it's a rational vote. Arguably, for that group of voters, it's rational to then not vote for independence, given some of the anticipated costs, and those costs have gone up post-COVID. And so I'm just interested, what are those voters going to be doing? If it is all about IndyRef 2, and that's what the unionist parties have been trying to make it, that's the concern of the SNP rather than about recovery, what are those voters going to do? And is this explaining why the SNP is tailing at the end?
I think that's a competence issue. I mean, those are your kind of your valence voters, your people who are voting for the SNP, not because they love independence, but because they just think they're the most competent party. And the thing that's been going on in Scottish politics is that the SNP, all it has to do is appear better than its opposition and better than the UK government, and it looks like a win. And in fact, on recent records, what the UK government has been doing and how the opposition parties have been performing, they've both been dismal in their own inimical ways. So the SNP hasn't had to be amazing in order to win that competence argument. And that, to a certain extent, that is still true. And what's interesting also with the competence data is that Labour was always second, but a distant second, and third on the issue of the economy, where the Conservatives came second after the SNP. And that was absolutely clear from the 2016 SES data. And it's been popping up in all the public opinion data since. But what we're seeing now is the Conservatives have lost that second place spot on the management of the economy, particularly if you mention anything to do with jobs or living standards. And I think partly that's them also getting hammered for their handling of Brexit. So I think overwhelmingly what you're seeing is the message of competence is one that is tied to COVID for the SNP. But the message of competence for the Conservatives is unfortunately for them kind of attached to their handling of Brexit. And if you're a competence voter who supports the SNP because you think they're better than the rivals, then the data suggests that that's still a present feature in what's going on in people's minds. But you're right. I mean, it's not a massive number, is it?
One final question for both of you. Which party do you expect will be the happiest the day after Super Thursday? Mark, do you want to kick off?
I think it's going to be the Greens. I think they could do better than anticipated. And they could be the party that calls the shots if the SNP doesn't have a majority of seats in the Scottish Parliament. So I think the Greens will have big smiles on their face next week.
I don't disagree with that. It does look like they're going to do well. For me, I think if Scottish Labour is able to reverse a very negative trend, I mean, their Euro performance recently in Scotland was just utterly dire. They were knocked down to fourth and fifth in a number of different contests. I think if they're able to halt that trend and even make some headway in terms of reversing that trend, that for them would be an incredible achievement. Because the post-mortem on the 2019 election revealed just the depth of pain in the Scottish Labour Party and also the lack of preparation and organisation. I think they did one poll between the two UK general elections. And often I've wondered, is no one polling in Scottish Labour? And it turns out, no, they haven't been. So if they're able to halt that, then I think that for them would be an incredible achievement. And that would make them very relieved indeed. I think for the SNP, it's slightly trickier, right? I mean, in one hand, if you don't get your majority, you've got a bunch of headaches. But also if you do have your majority, you've just got a different set of headaches in a way.
Okay, thanks. On the assumption that Anna Sarwar is listening or somebody else from Scottish Labour is, I will happily do you a good deal on lots more Scottish polling. But it just leaves me to say thank you to Elsa Henderson. Thank you to Mark Shepherd. Thank you so much for your contributions. This has been extremely interesting. But thank you very much for listening. Please remember to like, subscribe, review, all these different things that help people hear about us, and do tell all of your friends and many of the people that you don't know, even if you haven't enjoyed the podcast. This is a Poddo podcast produced by Nick Hilton, and our theme tune is by Joe Button.
For more details, go to podopods.com, and for sales and advertising, email nick@podopods.com.
And yes, that's spelled podopods.com.